And for everybody else, just a little heads up, this summer, we are going to go through a type of a series. We're not going to do necessarily consecutive verses throughout the scriptures, but we are going to go through consecutive segments as we spend some time looking at various aspects of the kings in 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. And the reason I'm doing this is I'm kind of following along with our two-year Bible reading plan. So each week, whenever I'm preaching, it'll be from the text either from that day or something in that week. And the reason I'm doing this is because during the summers, we typically don't have our life groups meeting. So you don't have that point of contact to sort of follow up with a text and think about it in community. And in doing this, one of my prayers and our hopes is that as you study, as you look at a text on Sunday, this enables you during the week to continue to explore, to have conversations with other people who are doing the same thing, and to examine the things that we've looked at together on a Sunday morning. So it should give us a commonality in what we're learning. Now, I can already hear some of you. Problem, Pastor, I'm not caught up in the reading. Kind of fell behind, maybe back in Leviticus or something. Don't worry about it, all right? Go ahead and just pick up with us from this point forward. This week, you only have to spend 4 days, I think, reading Ruth, and then starting the following week, we'll be going into the book of 1 Samuel. So follow along in the reading, and if you don't know where to access that, it's on our app. It's just under the Bible readings. You can click down there and find the various passages that we're looking at. So I'm going to be starting from 2 Samuel, or 1 Samuel chapter 1. So if you have your Bibles, you can go ahead and do that. I'm sorry, I got all my numbers mixed up. It's 1 Samuel chapter 2. That's where we're beginning. Some of you, particularly you older folks, but you don't have to be older to know about this. There was a song by a singer-songwriter, Don McLean, many years back. Remember it? Bye Bye, Miss American Pie. And the whole purpose behind the song, I mean, it's a really fun song, and it has all these lyrics, and it just kind of hops along and not that hard to memorize and sing along with. But as you start to listen to the words behind the song, you realize there's something deeper than some fellow who just wants to throw out some Moon Spoon June type of lyrics to engage you. Evidently, McLean felt like music was changing in the 60s. And he had this reminiscence, this remembrance of just how he enjoyed it so much when the rock and roll was a little bit simpler. And as you listen to the song and the lyrics, you start to just get this following of this history of the 60s and these different singer-songwriters and events that have come along that, in his opinion, helped the music to die. And it's sort of a lament almost in how he articulates this. But the song had a much greater meaning than what many people just initially thought as they began singing and following along. Now, I mention that because what we're looking at here today is a woman's prayer. It's a prayer, and it's a prayer of thanksgiving. Some people have referred to it as a psalm, but it isn't merely just a prayer. There is a depth here, a deeper meaning behind it. And what it does is in and through this prayer, God is going to use Hannah's words to give you an overview of the entire books of 1 and 2 Samuel. What you experience in these verses kind of is something that you are going to see unfold before you repeatedly as the story unfolds in those two books. And so let me start by saying this. When you read Samuel's books, you have to start really from a human perspective. And from that human viewpoint of the story, it shows us how God continues to adapt his reign into the lives of men. Now, some of you are bristling with that. What? God adapts to us? I thought God was sovereign. He is sovereign. And yet it's in and through his sovereignty that he will adapt to what people are doing. Great case in point. He told Israel he would be their king. They said, we want a king like the other nations. And God adapted. Now, he didn't necessarily give up his throne, so to speak, but he said, okay, you want a king? I'll adapt. And he let them have that. But I want you to know that something. God never gives up and surrenders his throne even when he adapts. God's people can reject him. They can reject his ways. But he will never be dethroned from his sovereignty. Cannot happen. He will always rule. And in the end, God will always accomplish what he designs. Always. In fact, that's the big idea behind the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. I've got that on a slide there, Sophie. That God can and will adapt, but he will never surrender to man to accomplish his ends. Really, the issue is, will man surrender to and align with God? Will man be a willing partner of what it is that God is doing and accomplishing? Or will God have to do it despite what we are doing? This is the timeless issue that we're faced with in these books, and we're constantly having our own hearts brought to bear as we examine this. I'm sure many of you have seen a small child, and the parents are trying to get that child in the car seat, and the child did not want to go, and then screaming and thrashing occurs, right? Never happened to your kid, but it always happened to somebody else's kid. Maybe you were that kid. But along the way, at some point, the parent more or less says, here's the deal. We're going to the destination. You can go kicking and screaming, or you can go calmly and enjoy it, but you're going. That's the bottom line. In the same way, working with God operates the same way. We can go kicking and screaming. We can go pushing back, or we can go purposing to align ourselves with who he is and what he wants to accomplish. And when we do that, the latter, there's great blessing that comes with it. But when we purpose, no, that's not what I'm going to do, and we continue to push back and go after the things that we want, it's not good. It's kind of like hugging a rose bush. You may get closer to that little pretty flower that you like, but it's going to come at tremendous cost and great pain. And that's what we can do with God. In the book of Esther, there's a particular scene in which she faced a quandary. She had to go make an appeal to the king on behalf of her people. It was a day and age where you didn't go to the king uninvited. If you did, you could be killed. Might be seen as some sort of assassination attempt, so they would take you out. And she's faced with this quandary, will I go? And it's when Mordecai comes to her and he responds with this from Esther 4:14, which is on the slide. If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. God will accomplish his ends. It's going to happen. Will we participate in that will? Or will he have to work despite us? In 2 Samuel chapter 2, we've got the microcosm of one woman's prayer, which then expands into the macrocosm of this truth throughout the next several chapters. Now, before I read chapter 2, you know me, I'm a context guy, so I got to bring you into the context before you just jump right into somebody's prayer. Chapter 1, I'm just going to give you a summary, and it all begins with a fellow named Elkanah. Elkanah had two wives. That is repulsive in our day, but remember, this is a day and an age and a culture where that was actually relatively common. And those two wives' names were Peninnah and Hannah, and Peninnah had children. And in that day and in that era, children were considered not only a blessing, but they were a big part of the big plan of God, that if God is going to give the Jew descendants, you need to have descendants so that that promise can continue. Many people felt if you didn't, it was part of God's curse on you. That wasn't exactly accurate, but a lot of people felt that way. And most people felt if you didn't have children, that's a problem. It was seen as a stain on you within that culture. So a lineage was expected. So much so that if your wife didn't give you a child, you might get another wife so that you could have a child. Didn't necessarily throw your first wife out, but you would have more so that you could have more children. And Hannah, Hannah's a woman who has been unable to have a child. The root of her name means grace and entreaty. How perfect, because that's exactly how she comes to God. She seeks God's grace by presenting her entreaty unto God. And she asks, would you give me a child? Not just would you give me a child, would you give me a son? If you'll give me that son, Hannah says, here's what I'll do. I'll turn around and I will give him back to you, Lord. He will be yours, devoted unto you in your temple. Grant me that, and he will be that permanent sign of devotion back to you. So it's a call. God, would you adapt to my situation? Would you change it? Intervene and fix this. You know, I mentioned at our last baby dedication that this is often the text that we look at and we refer back to as the model when considering dedicating your own children unto the Lord. Well, when she does this, there's a man named Eli. He's one of the last judges, also one of the priests of the temple. And after hearing Hannah's story, he, in essence, sends her away, and he says this, may God grant this. She goes home, and that's exactly what God did. he granted her her request. He gave her a little boy, named him Samuel, whose name means, my God, or it's God's name, El, meaning strength and power. So she weaned him. She took him back to Shiloh. Now remember, Shiloh is like Jerusalem before Jerusalem existed. All right, Jerusalem wasn't always the place where the temple was. I got a picture up here of what Shiloh looks like now. You can see that little tent there in the background. But we know for a fact that is where the temple tabernacle sat at one time in Shiloh. And Shiloh is like a mini Jerusalem because it sits just like Jerusalem at the bottom of this bowl of mountains or hills. They call them mountains. You know, we would call them hills. And if you call them, if you live in the out west in the Rocky Mountains, I don't know what you call them. Stones, maybe. But it's here the temple was established and it was set up. This is the place where God would reside, where his tabernacle was. And so Hannah takes this little boy after she's weaned him. Estimates are somewhere between about 3 years of age and about 6 years of age. And she leaves him there under the service of the Lord. Now that is all of the events that lead up to the prayer that we find in chapter 2. And in this prayer, not one request of God. She already had a request. He answered it. Now she's responding to it. And it's going to be about a praise unto God for his sovereign might on the earth. And I told you before, as you continue to go through the book of 1 and 2 Samuel, you start to see this theme constantly. You start asking, can God raise men up and pull them down? Can God accomplish things through normal means? Can God accomplish things through supernatural means? We'll see both. Can God raise up kings? You bet he can. Can God remove kings? You'll see that as well. And it makes you stop and ask yourself, can God elevate you? Can God remove you? Throughout the book, men and women are constantly battling with this idea as they see events unfolding around them. And they wonder at times, God, are you at work? God, do you see? God, are you even willing to be involved? And repeatedly, what we get to discover is he's always on his throne and he's always orchestrating and running the events and running time. But quite often, people don't feel like he is, just like Hannah was struggling. You ever felt this way? Oh, everybody say yeah. Yeah, every one of us has felt this way. We've struggled with it. God, where are you? Why aren't you doing something? Just watch the news. You start to feel that way, don't you? Well, Samuel's whole story is going to let us know that God is moving history to a predetermined point. And you'll see it in the events. In fact, the Ark of the Covenant is going to be captured by enemies. Think God can do something about that? The next lineup of priests, they're going to be evil men. They are not good. Can God do something about that? The nation is going to reject God's kingship for an earthly king. Is there something God will do about that? What will he accomplish in and through it? And what will God do when leaders go rogue and they go off the deep end and things get bad like Saul will do? Can Saul thwart God's plans and his goals ultimately? We're going to see at times how God's going to adapt, again, from a human perspective, how he will adapt to operate, and yet never will he surrender his rule, and he will bless those who surrender unto him. And you're going to see fortunes reversed. People that don't initially obey God, but they turn around and change, and God adapts and blesses them. And people who start to obey, but then don't, and God adapts, and he deals with them as well. And what my prayer is, that as you look at this, you get a really big view of God and who he is and his might and his power. He is the great judge, the overseer of human destinies. He's the rewarder of those who seek him. And both empowerment and victory are always for those ultimately who fear him. But for all others, he's an overpowering authority who is able to dispense a fearful judgment. So how's that for an intro? Let's see how Hannah's song presents to us these themes about God, beginning in chapter 2, verse 1. It says, then Hannah prayed and said, my heart exalts in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth speaks boldly against my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. The horn here represents strength. When you think of an animal that has horns, that is both a defensive and an offensive weapon that that animal has that can use to fight against an enemy. Hannah equates the horn with God. And that horn has a strength that is not within her, it is within him. God is her champion. He is the one who can save. He is the one who can rescue. But he's not merely strong. Verse 2, there is no one holy like the Lord. Indeed, there is no one beside you, nor is there any rock like our God. So God is very much alone in his holiness. That's what makes him so holy. He's separate. He's otherworldly. He's above them. No one is like him. And there's a uniqueness in him and an incredible stability and strength. When we have people come to visit us, a lot of times what we'll do is we'll take them out here to Bear's Den of Rocks. And we'll hike all the way to the top, and then we'll stand on those rocks that are at the top. Not one time have I stood on those rocks and they ever felt shaky to me. Because it is a big rock. And I don't affect or impact it at all. I am solid when I stand on this. And that's the image that Hannah gives us here with God. He is stable. He is trustworthy. He is holy. And now Hannah looks at the people. Anyone who might remember, or not remember, but forget that about God and begin to think of themselves, of how mighty and strong they are. And in verse 3, she contrasts that. She says, boast no more so very proudly. Do not let arrogance come out of your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and with him actions are weighed. In your Old Testament, the book of Jeremiah, there's a fellow named Baruch. And Baruch is being told by God to take the words of Jeremiah and write them down, and then go take them to the king. And the king was wicked. King was evil. And so as he goes, he does this, and he delivers that book and that message of God. And when the king receives this, he listens to it, and then he takes that part of the scroll. He took his knife. He just sliced it up. And he tossed it in the fire. Next scroll, read, cut, toss it to the fire. And Baruch was very disappointed in this. Because Baruch's kind of like all of us. We're going to usher in the kingdom. We're going to obey God. We're going to get this stuff done. And we're going to see God work in all these amazing ways. It's going to be great. It's going to be powerful. And there had to have been some aspect of him where he felt like, and I'm going to be great. But it's in this text, in this segment of the story, that God had a message for Baruch when he said this, and I got this on the slide. But you, are you seeking great things for yourself? Do not seek them. For behold, I'm going to bring disaster on all flesh, declares the Lord, but I'll give you your life. And God's message to him was that the king might reject God's rule, but God and his sovereignty would not be dethroned, even with an unrepentant, powerful, and mighty king. So the king's rejection did not change at all God's plan and God's ultimate destiny. And if Baruch did think that his actions were going to bring about this great revival, he overstepped his bounds. What he had to do was remember his role is to be faithful. You be faithful, Baruch. I'm the one who's controlling destiny. You align with me and then leave me to handle the outcomes and where this is going to go. And it's here where Hannah is also remembering. There was a time where she couldn't bear children. It was outside of her. I don't know, did Peninnah taunt her? Or was it just the fact that Peninnah always had children? That was enough to just set her back daily. But she knew this is outside of my control. I don't get to make this call. This is something only God can do. And she, as a result of becoming pregnant, took no pride in being able to now conceive. She recognized, I couldn't do it. This was all God's doing. And God can take the high and bring them low, and he can take the low and he can bring them high. And to the person who would boast today, thinking, well, I can control this, God in his sovereign power can reverse that good state of fortune that individual might be in. Verse 4, the bows of the mighty are shattered, but the feeble gird on strength. Those who were full hired themselves out for bread. Now, that's going to be a theme you'll see throughout Samuel's books. The strong can be broken. We'll see this when the mighty King Saul fails to obey. And as a result of failing to obey, God reverses his fortune. And God says, I'm going to take you down. I'm going to replace you with this guy, David, who's the lowest of the low, the youngest in a line of his family. And God says, that's the one that I will choose. And when Saul determines that and purposes to kill David, there's nothing he can do to actually accomplish that goal, because God has purposed that David would succeed, and God continued to keep him safe. Verse 5, just as God can bring down the mighty low, he can do what he did for Hannah, and he can set the low in a high place. That's how verse 5 continues. Those who were hungry, they cease to hunger. Even the barren gives birth to 7, but she who has many children languishes. So again, this was outside of Hannah's control. She didn't get to make the call on this. This was something only God could do. And when she says, I can give birth to 7, it's a literary device. It would be like today, we would say something like, she could give birth to 100 children. The idea being limitless. That's what God can do in his might and in his power, if that's what he wants to accomplish. But the contrast, those who see themselves as strong, they can languish. And they can languish that quick, because strength and might of man can be overcome in just a moment. And I'll be willing to bet every single one of you here has a point in your life, at least one, that you can look back on and you can see how things turned in just a second. Because all God has to do is say the word, and instantly life changes. Verse 6, the Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. And the Lord makes you poor and rich. He brings low. He also exalts. You remember the story of Joseph. Starts out in his home, favored with a coat. Then he's sold into slavery. And then instead of things getting better, they get worse. He gets thrown in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And yet it's in and through that, after many years have gone by, that God then elevates that man to put him second in power in the nation, in the most powerful nation in the world at the time. The Lord was overseeing it all, every bit. Job, here's a guy who life is great. He's doing wonderful and he's serving God. And then within the span of a few hours, he not only loses his home, but he loses all of his children. That I can't imagine. And then given a little bit more time, he loses his health on top of that. And God was overseeing it all. Samson, here's a guy who's strong, never been defeated, always had the Spirit of God on him and the power of God on him. But then after this long period of time where he began to disregard God and follow after his lusts, in just a moment, God had his strength removed. And then his eyes that steered him away were also removed. And it happened in just a moment. Well, in verse 8, there's another reversal. This one, though, a little bit more of a positive note. It says, he raises the poor from the dust, and he lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with nobles and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he set the world on them. So David, he can come from the lowest tribe, the youngest child, and be elevated to the kingdom. Later, you'll read about a woman named Abigail. This is a woman whose foolish husband has her in a pathway of collision course with being killed by David. And as a result, this woman goes, takes an action that God leads her to, and she makes an appeal in humility to David. She not only saves her life, she saves the life of everyone around her. And then God then takes that woman and winds up elevating her to a new status. This is God's doing. Verse 9. Now we go back to the sovereignty of God. He keeps the feet of his godly ones, but the wicked ones are silenced in darkness, for not by might shall a man prevail. The Apostle Paul put it like this in 1 Corinthians 4. We have a verse. For who regards you as superior? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as though you did not receive it? So while we might work, and we should work, and we should work hard at the causes and the purposes by which God has before us, God is the one who's ultimately going to be doing the building. He is the one who is going to be doing the accomplishing. And for anybody who might forget that and think it rests on me, they got verse 10. Those who contend with the Lord will be shattered. Against them he will thunder in the heavens, and the Lord will judge the ends of the earth. So God deals with those who are in opposition to him. But for his own, for his anointed, he will give strength to his king and will exalt the horn of his anointed. Hannah begins talking about a horn and strength. She ends talking about a horn and strength. And in both cases, she highlights it isn't within her, it is God, the one who is her strength. That's the horn of her salvation. So as you're reading, And I hope you will join us in this summer as you continue to explore this. You'll see God has a destiny. History is going to a point. It is. Now, we can get into all the theological depths of it and how much control does God have and what is he doing. For the purposes of this book, I would say, don't worry about it. Here's what we're to concern ourselves with. If this is the sphere God has me in, how will I comply and how will I obey so that I will align with him, to know his will and align with him through what I have and let him work through you? My prayer is that God doesn't have to work despite me. Kieran and I have said that many times with child rearing, you know. Sometimes we feel like God worked despite us and not through us. But that's not the way we want to be, is it? We want God to work through us as we're surrendered and submitted unto him. And it's interesting, in these two books, at the very end of 2 Samuel, a couple of chapters before the end, David also has a song. He also has a prayer. And it's in there, he ends almost the same way, speaking about the strength and the horn of God when he says, God is my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation. It's bookended this way, folks. You're meant to see God as you see these human stories. God is always at work, and you can trust and depend on him. He is sovereign. And his sovereignty doesn't mean he's going to take all your problems away. His sovereignty doesn't mean that life's just going to go all wonderful and rosy. Sometimes there'll be seasons where that happens, and sometimes there won't be, just like Hannah was going through. But this book will remind you that you have to take your eyes off of what's going on, and you got to elevate them to look at God himself. And when you see him, when you see his goodness, and you see his wisdom, that is meant to build your faith, your trust in him, that he is taking this to a point that while you don't get the purpose behind what you're going through, there is a purpose, and you can trust him with it, no matter what that might bring, because it's his love, it's his rule that you're to engage in and allow that to build your trust. It was about midway through my flying career, I distinctly remember one flight out of all the hundreds, and I was flying with this one particular captain. He was just an awesome fellow. And as we're getting ready to go, one of the flight attendants comes up and she goes, we got a real problem back here. And I said, well, what's that? And she goes, it's not a passenger. It's the lead flight attendant. She is being awful. She's bitter. She's angry. She's causing problems. She's mistreating people. And so I looked at him and he looked at me and he knew as a captain, that's my job. But he got a big smile on his face and he goes, I'll tell you what. You take care of all this. You finish up the checklist. I'm going to go work with her. So he goes away, and he's back there for a little while, not a real long time. And then he came back. I said, well, how'd it go? And he said, you know, overall, it went great. I said, well, what'd you do? And he said, well, I just looked at her, and I said, listen, I don't remember her name. I'll just call her Phyllis. Hopefully there's no Phyllis here. Phyllis, I'm glad you're here. I know you're qualified. I know you're an amazing flight attendant because you're the lead flight attendant. And we're getting ready. We're going to Denver. You know that. Nothing's going to change that unless, you know, God Almighty shuts it down. But because we're going to Denver, here's what I need from you. We can make this trip wonderful for everybody. We can make it miserable. And I accept maybe things aren't going so good in life right now for you. Maybe you're going through a hard time and a hard season. I'd love to help you after the flight, visit with you, help you do whatever I can. But can you help me? Can you make sure that the trip is pleasant? Take care of the people. Meet their needs. Put up with the ones that are rude. And let's make this a wonderful flight. And so I went, whew, we'll see. And when we landed, Phyllis was great. She did great. She just needed the reminder. This plane is going to its destination. We can go kicking and screaming. Or we can go in alignment with the vision and the direction of what it is that we're called to do is aviation and aviation helpers. So let's make it good and take care of these folks. It's the same way with you. God has a destination. Sometimes it's not very pleasant. He's calling you. Align with him. Align with him. As you follow him, allow him to work in and through you. Good days and not so good days. We're not going to go kicking and screaming. Let's go in submission and watch as his sovereign will is played out regardless. But let it be through our obedience, our joy, our walk, our submission unto him.